Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and great to have back Jesse LeGrew. He is an information security architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. And so we're going to be talking with him about lots of things, from how to tell good information from bad on the internet, what it means to have the right to repair your electronics, fiber internet, and what that's all about. So, any experiences trying to repair your own electronics? Have you found some useful ways to tell if a website is credible or not? What other tech questions might you have? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Last night, before I went to bed, I got out my eyeglass wipes for cleaning my eyeglasses, which I usually do before I go to bed, and then I swiped it over my phone. And I wonder if that's a good way to clean. I mean, I figure if it's good enough for your eyeglasses, it ought to work for your phone.
Yeah, and it always depends on the material being used.
Yeah.
For a lot of different devices that people touch on a day-to-day basis, which may be different for eyeglasses, they have special materials on top of it, so when you touch it, it doesn't smear or create an issue with the glass. And especially me, knowing that I have glass and have had them for quite a long time, you have a lot of options when you get them in terms of what kind of materials are on the glasses. So everybody's glasses is a little bit different and may react to different chemicals in a different way. So for most, you know, smartphones, iPads, a lot of those do have a special coating that if you put a harsher chemical, or really any chemical, it could interact and actually damage that layer. So it depends on what was in the spray or what you might have used for your eyeglasses. It's possible it could have a detrimental effect to that surface coating. Usually they just say any kind of dry microfiber cloth, wipe it off, and usually that's okay. But you can get special cleaners usually from a variety of stores, and they'll actually have it specifically for different handheld devices. But a lot of individuals just state, if you really need to, you can actually use just kind of like mild soapy water or just water itself, and that's it. The challenge with that is you don't want to get too much water somewhere where it shouldn't be, where you have the power cord opening, headphone jack, or anything like that. So usually a dry wipe with a microfiber cloth and kind of, you know, using circular patterns to wipe it away is good.
Mm-hmm.
And microfiber is a great material to use, not just for glasses or for personal devices, but for even day-to-day cleaning.
So, and of course, you know, people are a lot more concerned about it with the coronavirus, you know, getting rid of the germs and bacteria.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the... I think for a variety of materials, it's pretty easy. If you have a tabletop, usually you're pretty safe of knowing how to clean it using disinfectant wipes. You can use a variety of different products that are out there. With day-to-day electronics you're using, it's a little bit more challenging because, you know, you don't want to use Windex, for example, on a computer screen or an iPad. You want to use either chemicals that were specifically made to clean it or even just clean it dry. Microfiber is still, you know, really recommended for a variety of electronic devices, and usually it's actually just recommended to be using it dry. And I think, you know, I can clean all my devices. Most of the time when you're considering germs, bacteria, viruses, or things moving from place to place, it's usually the devices that you're not using on a day-to-day basis. If I'm using my computer at home, for example, I'm the only one using it.
Yeah.
I'm really the individual that's bringing something in or taking something out of that environment. So it's actually more important on what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis to make sure that my hands are clean or what I'm doing with my hands. So if somebody did, for example, have a computer lab, you can clean the entire lab. But as soon as people start coming in to use it, then there's the challenge. You know, not touching your face with your hands is a very important step, because you can go into a dirty computer lab, get everything, you know, at least on your hands, really dirty, but still wash your hands at the end of that and still be relatively safe. And I think that's one of the pieces where cleaning is always a good idea, but it's all those day-to-day habits that we do or don't have that actually impact it a far greater deal.
I saw somewhere an article on the keyboards where there's a roller now that you can just roll across the keys.
Yeah, and I saw a couple of things. One is a roller and one's kind of like a putty. So you actually you pour or kind of push it onto the keyboard, obviously after it's disconnected. So before cleaning anything, always disconnect everything,
yeah.
Especially keyboards, because I've done it before where I've wanted to wipe it off. But, you know, it starts typing keys and it gets really awkward really quickly. But a putty that you can actually put on top of it, it kind of seeps into the little crevices and you just peel it away and it takes all the weird little pieces of grime and everything out.
Oh, that's
not
cool.
Only on the surface, but even in the cracks. I've actually went kind of the extreme measure of at least working on computers, taking keyboard keys out. So you can actually soak the keyboard keys and put them back together. That requires a lot of patience and a lot of time, but you actually can do that. But a lot of those options with putty to get a lot of that grime out is really good, especially when people tend to eat at their desk, whether it's at home or at work. Things just get in there, whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
So there is the recommendation of using like air canisters to clean it out and get that debris out. The other reason I've taken out the keys in the past, you can only get so much out if there's only small spaces for things to kind of get blown out using a can of air. And it can make it a little bit easier to clean when you have a consistent surface. Another nice thing I like to use with keyboards, if you do want to disinfect it, since you don't want to use usually alcohol or anything on a variety of screens, you can actually take like a Q-tip and either an isopropyl alcohol. I'd say some would probably recommend mixing it with water to make it a little bit less potent, but then you can actually rub and get in between those key areas that otherwise, if you just wiped it off with a cloth, it might be a little bit more challenging. But every keyboard's a little different. Some it actually might be really easy to wipe off with one cloth. Some you might have to kind of dig into crevices. But it can be a little bit challenging, but, you know, that's your you know, what you're using on a day-to-day basis. And the mouse, too, is another important thing to clean. Those two things you're touching all the time. If somebody else is going to be using it, they're probably not going to be going up touching your screen all the time unless it's a touchscreen device. It's always going to be that keyboard and mouse that people are really interacting with and probably more important to keep more clean.
Talking today with Jesse LeGrew about a whole variety of things relating to your computer and your phone. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. You know, there are a lot of websites, apps, news sources, other online kinds of things, and we're not going to be familiar with all of them. And unfortunately, not all of them are sharing accurate information either.
Yeah, and that's been a challenge for a while, and that challenge increases over time as there's more individuals sharing information. The nice thing about the day and the age we live in right now is information is freely available. But it's really hard to take all this information and sift it down to understand how much of it might be accurate or not, how much of it is opinion versus fact. And one of the things that's at least been helpful to me is to look for disparate sources of information, even ones that may disagree with each other, to understand kind of where information is sitting. There's always trusted news sources that you can go to, but even then could become a challenge of creating kind of a feedback where you're looking at one perspective of an issue or a set of data, and it's actually useful to also look elsewhere. So taking samples at different areas can at least help understand what may or may not be more accurate, or at least to help understand different sides of issues. But it always depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking for facts, I would look for, you know, institutions that are really responsible for gathering that data. Usually, whether it's the governmental research or higher education, there's a variety of resources that are also vetted scientifically, mm-hmm. so that other individuals can, one, go through and sift through the information, but also replicate what's been done to ensure that what people are expecting is actually accurate. So it's being able to repeat something and know that, yep, this is in fact true, or I haven't been able to disprove it. Sometimes those are really harder to find. It's usually a lot less cut and dry, where we know this is a fact or it's not. There is interpretation built in. And if you don't have all the information, you can really—it's really difficult to make an informed decision.
Yeah.
So it's actually been useful for me to challenge myself and look for different areas of this is at least what I think and what I've been hearing, but what have other people been saying? That at least helps me to think about it in a different way, and to at least vet that information myself. It's still challenging, and I could say
right.
I have two trusted news sources. I'm going to always go to that information. And it may be factual, although it still is a perspective that might be narrower in the grander scheme of things.
We have many callers online who want to visit with you. Lucille in Luxembourg has something. Let's go to Lucille.
Hello.
Hi, Lucille. What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about cleaning your computer you know, the typing thing.
Keys, the keyboard, yeah.
There you go, keyboard. I take, I went and I got the small box of Saran Wrap, and I tightly put it over the keyboard, and when it gets dirty, I throw it away, put a clean one on, and I don't have to worry about getting in between the keys or spraying or anything else. It works like a charm.
Good for you, Lucille,
yep.
And that should work just fine, Jesse.
Yeah, that's it's a great idea, and if you actually do go to different areas where the things do have to be a little bit more clean, having a surface that you can get dirty, remove, replace, also it also saves time on cleaning, and you can actually get different keyboard covers as well that you can actually purchase that basically kind of do the same thing. Like silicone keyboard covers you can purchase. Many people actually get them just because they look nice. You can have a different color, and the feel on the keyboard, the tactile response is a little bit different. But you can also have two of those keyboard covers, put one on, use it, take it off, clean it, and put the other one on, and you can kind of have a rotation where you can be cleaning one and you know, having a clean one ready when you need to.
Or like
that.
Lucille, just take some Saran Wrap.
And Saran Wrap would work. That I would be worried about it sticking to my fingers.
Yeah.
But that's probably because my own fingers aren't clean and they should be clean in the first place. But Saran Wrap, any kind of cover you can do that is helpful, especially if that surface is clean when you're able to put that on your keyboard.
Paul in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Paul.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I've got a micro SD card that's corrupt. What is the best way to try to retrieve the data that's on that micro SD card? An inexpensive way, I should say.
The micro SD card, it's going to be a little tricky. A lot of the solid state devices, whether they're solid state hard drives or SD cards, many of the times when they fail spectacularly, and you're not able to actually get any data off whatsoever. A recommendation I would have, because if it doesn't currently mount, you cannot see it on one of your devices or on your computer, my next recommendation would actually be to reach out to a data recovery company just to get their input. I have a feeling they're not going to be able to get the data off because there's kind of limitations in terms of what they can do, but you would actually need a specialist in this case to really take a look and see if there is something they could do. Usually they're going to give you an idea just with a simple phone call. It's very likely that information will not be able to be recovered.
No, that's too bad. You can join in with your computer or phone questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGru. And Tom in Nelson, Wisconsin, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hello, folks. A simple question, I think. I want to cut my cable cord on my television set, and I was thinking about going to Hulu, but I didn't know if I have fast enough internet speed. I think I have 25 MPS, is it?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's fast enough or not.
Yeah, and
what does the MPS actually stand for?
It is megabits per second.
Okay. Yeah. And is 25 fast enough?
Yeah, 25 is fast enough for 4K and for a majority of streaming. Normally, they recommend about 3 megabits per second for kind of standard quality or lower quality streaming. 25 megabits per second, and I say bits because if it's a capital B or a lowercase b, it actually does matter. So in this case, 25 megabits per second, which is the small b or lowercase b, should be good enough for most streaming that you're going to have to do at home. I think even for 4K, that should be fine.
All right. There you go, Tom. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, I tell you what, sometimes, and we've been talking about this already, it's come up, sometimes when electronics break, but you don't want to have to buy a new one, you just want to fix it yourself maybe. Maybe a battery stops keeping charge, as an example, or your screen breaks. Pretty hard to do right now to fix it yourself. And there's something called Right to Repair.
Yeah, there's a it's kind of interesting because there's a variety of challenges right now with repairing your own devices. Primarily, it really is the device still supported after I actually repair it? So that's one of the issues. I think there's also some questions from manufacturers in regards to intellectual property rights, and if somebody taking apart a device will like divulge some secrets that they don't want to divulge. Personally, I like the idea of being able to repair something that I have. I think I'm still responsible and accountable for repairing it correctly, so I still need to be able to do the right thing. But it also, you know, allows me to learn. I can repair it potentially a little bit more inexpensive. It does increase some competition between other companies as well in terms of being able to deliver a service that's cost-effective, because if you're the only repair area in a city, you know, you kind of have a monopoly in the market in that little area of being able to do something, kind of competing with people who are also personally fixing their own devices could raise a little bit of competition. But I think being able to repair your own devices is a nice thing. And there shouldn't be as much of a challenge with...
Well, companies don't want you to have the
right
schematics.
Yeah, they don't want you to have the information. Most of it, I mean, you can figure out if you start to disassemble it. Repair centers will have information to disassemble it. I think most of the time there's two challenges. One, the end user is going to screw the repair up, and so then they don't want to support it. And then two is going to be, I have secret information I don't want you to see. In that regard, I think it's usually not too secret. You have the physical device anyway. If somebody really wanted to get the information, they're going to be able to get it. They own the device. A right to repair, I wouldn't really anticipate to actually resolve that issue. So if they say you can't repair it, if somebody really wants to get that information, they're going to find a way to disassemble it and get that information anyway. If there was a concern in terms of you're going to get too much information and you're going to be finding flaws in our devices, I actually also think that's a good thing because it helps to keep manufacturers and companies accountable to doing the right thing in terms of having devices that meet the expectations of, you know, the customers. Is it secure? Is it doing the things that I want it to do? Is it not doing the things I don't want it to do? I think these are all good things to be explored because I think it also makes the products better, but it can also assist with accountability of the companies that we rely on a day-to-day basis for all these services and devices.
Well, and you think about, I hate talking alarmist, but if this corona outbreak, for example, could shut down a lot of companies that make parts of that, if those parts aren't available and so you need to fix what you've got.
Right. And it's a good thing to be able to get a device up and running. So in some ways, kind of doing more with less, where I think mostly on a day-to-day basis, we're used to replacing things, whether it's full devices or even parts. Although if we have to live in a situation where we can't replace a device, we have to limp along with what it has for a year, a decade, being able to have that information to do so is really important. Otherwise, you know, you simply don't have the device. And even when thinking about, let's say, a telecom company, if they can't use a phone and they can't buy a new phone, they're not using the phone. And so even the income, the revenue generated by the telecom company would be lower as well. So there's, you know, a desire to keep that device running. People want it to run. I mean, if companies that leverage subscriptions based on those devices functioning, that's a challenge too. So if you can't buy a new one, it's really important to be able to fix it so you can continue to use it, either because the resources aren't there worldwide or just in your area. And it's really useful to be able to have that.
We have Mary in Pewaukee with us now. Mary, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Hi. Yes, I'm having a problem with my computer where sometimes I'll turn it on and I won't get anything but a blank screen, and then I'll shut it down. And then after that, I will wait a bit, try it, and I might get my, you know, normal icons where I can use my computer. I don't know if it's a modem problem. It's hit and miss. In other words, maybe two or three times when I turn it on, I'll get the two or three out of five, let's say, you know, it's going to allow me to go ahead and use my functions. And then one other problem that I have with it, so I'm just wondering if I need a technician out or bring my modem in somewhere, is that if I leave the computer, this is just when I'm home, obviously, just with the, you know, the monitor and the keyboard and the modem and all that. Okay, then for if I leave it for a half an hour or an hour and I go back, having left it on to be able to continue something, I then have no cursor. It's just like the screen is still there, but I can't move around within it. So, I have to shut it down and wait and then try again. It's hit and miss.
So for the actually looking at the issue when it sounds like there's some kind of computer issue, definitely. When the computer freezes after you haven't used it for about 30 minutes or the cursor doesn't work, have you tried hitting in any of the keyboard keys to see if it will respond?
Yeah, I've done that, sure.
Has it responded?
And it doesn't seem to be doing anything.
Okay.
It's kind of like just out of commission when it feels like it.
It definitely sounds like there is probably some kind of hardware issue, most likely. I'm guessing, do you have a PC-compatible computer or do you have a Mac?
PC-compatible.
Okay. And when the display, when you turn it on and the display doesn't turn on, do you simply get a completely black screen or do you get like
black.
A...
Black, yes.
Okay.
Yes, black screen.
So if you're not seeing the display and it's freezing every now and again, I have a couple guesses at what it could be. But in the end, it's really hardware. something's physically problematic with the device in some way. My normal guess would be hard drive because it's probably one of the most common devices to fail outside of a power supply. And your device does power on, granted intermittently. But I would say that it's probably a good idea to actually either have somebody come and take a look at it to see what might be broken or take it into a repair center. I do get the impression that there is a physical problem with the device. One thing you could try just to see if it happens consistently is unplug all the devices that you have plugged into your computer and try to turn it on. See if that does change any of the issues. Before plugging in it or before turning it back on, you want to plug back in the monitor cable as well. But it can tell you at least if it does turn on or turn off consistently when those other devices are turned off, it could be a different device that's actually plugged into your computer that's causing a problem. And sometimes reseating cables actually will resolve an issue if something's a little bit loose. But then you can at least see, is it something plugged in or is it the computer itself? I have a feeling it's probably the computer. I would still guess it could be a hard drive when it's freezing. It could be software, but I really doubt it because normally when you turn on a computer, you're going to get what's called a post or a power on self-test. Usually you're going to see the manufacturer's logo pop up before you see Windows loading, and then you'll get your icons. If you don't even see that initial pop-up with the manufacturer. That's definitely a more fundamental issue, and at least for me would lead towards a hardware problem.
So there you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Looks like you may need to take it in and have somebody take a look at the hardware issues there. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Glenda emailed to say that every time her Windows 10 updates, she loses her Wi-Fi connection. Why does this happen, and what can she do?
So I would have a couple guesses. Windows updates can install drivers in addition to main software. So it could be that Windows installed a new wireless driver that could be causing an issue. It could also be an issue with the wireless connection itself. What I'd probably do to try to resolve it, I'd probably reboot the wireless modem or wireless access point, assuming that they own the device themselves. And on the Windows 10 computer, I'd probably also remove that wireless connection, basically delete it or forget it, and then reconnect to it and join to that wireless network again. Sometimes creating that wireless network will resolve some issues too.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Mel in the Northwoods emailed with a question. Is it difficult for a novice computer user to do his own upgrade from Windows 7 Home Edition to the new Windows 10 using the free Microsoft download from CNET? Anything other that he would need to know?
Yeah, for any computer upgrade, it always depends. Everything can go fine until it doesn't. So one thing I always recommend with any upgrade, especially a large operating system upgrade, is to back up everything on your device. Anticipate for it to fail and that your computer's not going to work afterwards. Most of the time, there's a large amount of testing done to ensure that doesn't happen, but it's always good to be prepared. So if it does, you at least have some method in order to kind of restore your computer to a known working state or have a professional help to restore it. So I'd still recommend it might work fine. Back it up beforehand just to make sure you have all your files and all your settings. There is a backup application built into Windows. There are also some third-party ones you can use. Go ahead and try the upgrade. If you do run into an issue, at least you have that backup, and that's why the backup is really, really important. It's very likely everything's going to work fine, and you're not going to have a problem. But if you do have a problem, you're going to be very, very happy you have that backup.
You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234. We will get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to John in Richfield, Wisconsin next. Hi, John.
Hi, this is John from Richfield. I have two questions. One is, do you actually need a virus checker if you're running Apple computers?
My recommendation for especially any device that has the large amount of capabilities that Apple, Mac OS, and Microsoft Windows has, or even Linux, is to have some kind of antivirus program. There are a couple of reasons. One, maybe there are not antivirus programs or viruses out there today, although there are. They could become more prevalent. Even if there weren't any viruses that might be available for the computer that you're using, it also does reduce the availability for those viruses to spread to other platforms that might be susceptible. So if you're using a Mac OS computer and you get a virus, but it's only for Windows computers, you're probably okay. If it goes to a PC, that PC might get infected. But if you're able to catch it on your Mac, it also reduces the availability for that virus to spread. So I always recommend it just to help the rest of the community that has computers as well. But there are also viruses that will be around for a variety of operating systems. Apple has had viruses in the past, and they've had them decades ago. It's just not as prevalent as Windows 10 or Windows systems today.
So what system would you use for Apple then?
There's a variety of free applications out there that you can purchase, and a lot of the other antivirus manufacturers that do sell I guess, quote unquote, more enterprise or larger home products. Do you have available options out there?
Okay. John, you had another question.
Yeah. My other question was, probably a year ago, it was announced that Intel processors had a basic flaw that made them vulnerable, made your computer vulnerable to being taken over. They came out with some patches for it, but they even announced at that time it wasn't really a fix. I just got a notice from ZDNet that, in fact, it isn't a fix. The flaw is still out there. It's unrepairable. Is it time to... And they said only the most current generation of Intel processors had this bug fixed. Do you know anything about that?
Off the top of my head, I do not. Although a lot of these vulnerabilities will arise there, especially when a flaw is actually baked into hardware. There's kind of a limitation of what you can do in software to be able to fix that. So there might be some what they call kind of mitigations that are available in the future to lessen the likelihood you could have that flaw taken advantage of. And I would just recommend for anyone, you know, keep your software and everything else you have up to date. Sometimes firmware upgrades will assist with some of the hardware challenges if there are flaws available for them. Sometimes, depending on the challenge, it might actually require, you know, physically replacing a device in order to remove all vulnerabilities from it. Every system that we use on a day-to-day basis has some vulnerability, and that's there is never going to be a system without one, at least from my standpoint. So that there's always going to be some kind of risk, and I would still keep plugged into at least updates as they're coming, but I wouldn't go ahead and just replace all your computers because of this flaw. Usually there are ways to protect yourself that at least lowers the risk of your device being compromised that you can do that doesn't require replacing the device itself.
So what would be an example of that?
So some common flaws that are available. One that's really difficult for Windows is SMB, which is Windows File and Print Sharing, or Remote Desktop. A lot of times there might be vulnerabilities there that could allow somebody to take remote control of your computer or even access your computer without supplying a username and password. One way to mitigate that risk is to have a host-based firewall or a network firewall to make sure that at least no one from the outside can get into your network to even attempt to communicate with your device. So that's kind of one example of having a mitigating control. The vulnerability is still there. We put a wall up so no one can actually hit that vulnerability. And, you know, it will assist to some extent. But if somebody gets inside your network, you know, you have a challenge there. So there's always a layer of defenses you can kind of put in between you or your device and the rest of the world. And it's usually those layers of defenses that are going to help. It could even be your internet service provider that has services available that everyone can take advantage of. And actually for free antivirus, that's another option I'd recommend because a lot of internet service providers actually do have security software that they make available for free as a customer.
John, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got another John on his way to Hurley, so let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, when I heard the lady talking about her Wi-Fi and then this gentleman talking about firmware updates, software updates, I use a satellite service, and I went to their latest box when they had to realign my dish. And immediately after that, I began having problems where when I was using my desktop and even my laptop, my home, desktop is hardwired, laptop is using Wi-Fi, it would drop out. So I finally had the cable service come out and I checked and everything was fine. And he said he'd seen this once before. And it had to do with that new device. And I found out, he said, you might want to check your Wi-Fi and make sure you have the latest firmware and software update. I'm running an Asus Wi-Fi. one of the newer ones, one of the more powerful ones, and that's what I did. And sure enough, they had firmware and software updates out there, and I found that this device operates over my in-house Wi-Fi at 5G, where everything else is running slower. And updated the firmware and the software, and it took care of my problem on the Wi-Fi itself. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but that's something that I've always been told. My brother was an MCSE and had his security clearances, and he said, you ought to be checking your Wi-Fi, making sure you got the latest firmware and software on it, because those can actually be compromised as well.
John, thanks very much for calling. And
yeah, it's a really good idea. Usually for a lot of the updates, even considering what you can get available from Microsoft, usually a lot of the driver packs, firmware updates, or software are usually available separately from the vendor directly or from the manufacturer website, then might be delivered through the Microsoft updates. Most of the time, driver updates actually don't get installed. They're usually turned off. So it's always a good idea to actually check your vendor website to actually see if there are new updates available so that you can actually get the latest software. Especially with video drivers, a lot of those are very specialized, and actually going directly to who made the driver or the video card can help you get a good set of driver software to help ensure that the device runs as smoothly as it should, but also that it's more secure.
And thanks again. Let's go to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I just heard on the local news, one of our local stations, that our local Wisconsin Technical College is offering courses on how to combat viruses and hackers, you know, basically cybersecurity for companies. And I thought, well, if a person could take that, you might be able to kind of defend your own computers or whatever from hackers or viruses, too.
Yeah, Ron, that's right. And that's the La Crosse Tech College.
Wisconsin Technical College.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I definitely recommend there's a variety of resources both online, but also in a variety of educational programs, including higher education, whether it's technical colleges or universities that actually have curriculum that are actually specifically for cybersecurity, or can also be more useful just for the day-to-day individual that wants to learn more about what some of the risks are out there, how to identify them, and how to protect yourself. One thing they always tell you is it's hard to know, you know, how to defend something if you don't know how to actually attack. And so training how to actually exploit vulnerabilities of systems does tell you something about how you can defend against those exploits. So it's kind of really useful. Think about your own house. How is somebody going to try to break into my house? Think about ways to do that and say, okay, well, I need a new lock here. It's really no different than with technology. It's just a different skill set.
Ron, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your electronics today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrew from Madison College. It's great to have him with us. And certainly, if you have a question, you can email at ideas@wpr.org or phone us at 1-800-642-1234. Anne in Madison up next. Hello, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a hotspot to use. It's my cell phone. I arranged it to have to be a hotspot for my computer to get online. And I just want to verify, someone told me that it is safe to use for financial work. Is that correct?
I'd say that using a hotspot is probably more secure than a variety of wireless networks you'd otherwise connect to in a coffee shop or somewhere else. Especially if the hotspot does allow for you to connect. Are you connecting wirelessly to the hotspot, or are you directly plugged into it?
No, it would be wireless.
Okay. As long as the wireless is secured, So if you do have to type in a passphrase, and normally you'll see it on the wireless setup of the device that it is like WPA2, for example, and you have a passphrase to access it, and that passphrase is, you know, relatively secure and complicated. It should be relatively safe to use for financial business. Do you have any, I guess, specific kinds of sensitive data that you're more interested in securing?
So, like, do you go and check your bank statements and things like that online?
No, more like paying bills.
Okay.
And for, I'd say as long as you are using a secure internet connection, so normally when you do connect, even on your computer, you'll notice a little lock on the wireless connection, that it is secure. With that, in addition to the websites that you're probably paying your bills on, if you make sure that the websites are HTTPS and that you see a little lock, I would be pretty secure with that as well. Usually, as long as all of the pieces between really the bank setup is good when you're logging into their website, in theory, it shouldn't matter the other connections that you're logged into, unless they're somehow decrypting your traffic and trying to read your information. But a hotspot for that and day-to-day usage, I would say it would be pretty secure. I would just make sure that you do have a passphrase and you do have a secure wireless setup on your phone itself.
There you go, Ann. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Ed in Northern Illinois. Hi, Ed.
Hi, I have a phone question.
Okay.
So this is on a Galaxy S9, and when I listen to the radio on such as WPR on their app or some of the other PBS stations that have their own app, I find that on a random basis, the signal cuts or the app cuts out, and it can happen between maybe every 10 to 25 minutes, somewhere in there. It's pretty much guaranteed it's going to lose the signal, and sometimes it comes back on its own. Sometimes you have to restart the app. Sometimes you just have to touch the phone, let the app come up, and then it comes back. And I've talked to Samsung about it, and they claim it doesn't happen. Have you ever heard of this?
I've had connectivity issues with a variety of applications in the past that are a little bit more inconsistent. When you're using any of these applications, are you normally in one location or are you moving?
It doesn't matter. I've actually set it, you know, down virtually next to the modem, you know, a high-speed Comcast modem, and just let it sit there and run on its own, and sure enough, it just keeps happening.
I know it cuts out. Yeah, I know when I'm listening to the public radio in my car occasionally, and there's this HD kind of factor that comes into play that cuts it out.
Yeah, and I actually, when I leave my house, everything works inside my house. When I'm in this weird in-between period where I'm using wireless at home and a cell service, I have basically a dead zone of about half a block until it gives up on the wireless and uses the cell service. So one thing I'd probably recommend to just see how it works is actually, one, turn off Wi-Fi and see how it works just on cellular, and potentially try it the other way around, where you're only using wireless and not cellular, at least for the data portion, to see if the streaming changes. You may or may not see a difference, but if you do, it will tell you whether it might be an issue with the device actually selecting one or the other. And in some of the applications, you can actually have it select a preference where you only want it to use wireless or you only want it to use cellular, but not make a decision itself on which one to use.
Hmm. Ed, does that help?
My office at home. Well, I'm sitting in my office at home, and it's cut out twice while I'm listening to Larry's program. And I'm just sitting at my desk, and the phone's sitting there, and there's a 150 megabit service in the house.
Does Does your phone currently, do you have enough cellular signal in your house to be able to stream without your home wireless connection?
Probably.
I would just
we have Xfinity, you know, and yeah. It works. Yeah, I'm in a suburb, so I got real good signal in of Chicago.
Okay. I would just to see what happens, turn off the wireless from your phone, let it only use cellular. Just see how it works. And if you have no issues, it could be some other indicator. It could even be a note not of your internet connection, but actually of the wireless device in your phone itself. Because it could still potentially be a hardware issue, a software issue, an internet issue, whether it's because of cellular or your internet service provider. I would turn off your wireless and just see what happens. If it works flawlessly, that tells you something.
Yeah.
If you still have issues, well, at least you know you still have the issues, and it could still be a cellular problem with individuals and maybe the amount of people using it at one time. But then if you're also able to go back and use only wireless and turn off the cellular, it will at least tell you something. Sometimes phones are just really bad at selecting which one to use, and until it really fails, it doesn't kind of fall over to the other internet connection. So I would try that at least to see how it works.
Worth a try, Ed.
Nice day.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Paul in Madison, your turn.
Well, good morning.
Hi, Paul.
Hi. We have a laptop computer, Windows computer, and when we bought it, it came, the seller put on Webroot for 3 years. Webroot security. When the 3 years came up, I was notified by Webroot with a pop-up saying it was the subscription was over. My internet service provider also provides a free security system, which I tried to download. I got a message saying that you must delete any other security programs. I tried to do that, and Webroot refuses to go away in the usual way when you go to usual way of doing it. I went through forums, tried various methods. It still refuses to go away. Right now we have Windows Defender, which comes with Windows 10, or now Microsoft Defender, I believe it's called.
Yeah.
Is that sufficient? Is there a way of getting rid of that Webroot that I know, or shall I just rely on the Windows, the Microsoft Defender?
So for Windows Defender itself, Windows Defender has evolved over the years and is a pretty good antivirus
program.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
It does receive a good amount of information from Microsoft, and Microsoft has done quite a bit of work over several years to improve that product, but also what they're doing in terms of just securing devices in general, whether they're end-user computers or enterprise servers running in the cloud. So I'd say there's the built-in product is a good product as long as it's kept updated and the definitions are kept updated, and I think that will continue to improve. So is it sufficient? No antivirus will capture everything, so certain antivirus programs are better at different things or may see one thing a little bit sooner than another. But it's a good product, and I would recommend using it, especially if you didn't want to purchase a security package that included a lot of other services you might not use. So I'd say it's a good product as long as it's kept up to date and you do have a working version or a recent version of Windows. On the second piece about Webroot, there are a few different things you can try to do. I'm guessing from what you've already done before, you've probably went to the control panel, went to programs and features, found the program, hit on install, and it's just not working. There are a few programs that will help to try and find artifacts of left behind software that could clean those up. And then when you try to install, it will hopefully see that Webroot is actually not installed. My guess is there's just a leftover of the application that's just sitting around on your computer, even though Webroot isn't running. And CCleaner or SpyBot Search and Destroy, and there's a variety of other applications out there. I've used those in the past, and they've been really, really helpful. They might be able to find some of those leftovers, clean them out, so that you can actually restart your computer and then try to install that other package again. But my guess is you just have a little remnant of the software laying out. you might actually be able to get a WebRoot uninstaller or a cleaner actually from WebRoot themselves. They might actually have it for customers that have had an issue uninstalling the software, and you might actually be able to use a different utility they offer to actually remove it. But I would also recommend taking a look at CCleaner or SpyBot Search and Destroy or Super Anti-Spyware. They help to do that as well.
And they're free.
And they're free.
They're free, so that's the best part. Paul, thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect at Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Jesse. You stay with us. We'll be back. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your computer and your phone and your software with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Questions for him, give us a call at Open Lines. Get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Cody emailed to ask if you could recommend, Jesse, an app to copy text messages from an Android phone to a PC.
Yeah, this one, there are a few different things you could do to back them up. So there are some applications. Since you do have an Android phone, most of them do actually pair with Google services, and there actually is a text message backup feature that is available through Google Drive. The one thing I have not tested is whether you can actually view the messages on Google Drive after you've backed them up, or if they're only available to actually restore onto a new device. So it's at least an option for backing it up. You can actually back up all of the information on an Android phone by plugging it in and backing up the actual data. I just haven't actually tried to find where the text messages are and how to read them. But if you do actually attach it as a storage device, you actually have full access to all of the storage on your Android phone, and you can actually copy that somewhere. The downside is you have to find some location of where to read it. I would try the Google backup or the Google Drive option at least to back it up so you'll have it. You can always restore it to a different device. It may also have the capability of allowing you to read it. I just am not sure.
Janet emailed with a question. She says when she turns on her treadmill and runs the belt, internet is interrupted. Wi-Fi is lost in the entire house. She says sometimes she's gotten it to work after moving the Wi-Fi unit, or it will work but at lower speeds. She's asked multiple people, internet provider, tech people at the store where she got the treadmill, electricians, random strangers. No answers.
So for this one, I was anticipating basically probably the motor in the actual treadmill is causing interference with the wireless signal for the device. There's a couple things to try. One, you could move the actual Wi-Fi device that you have that's serving wireless through your house. That may or may not be possible because, you know, if you have cable or something else, you kind of have a central point where everything comes in. You could get a longer cable and move it somewhere else in the house. You also might be able to boost the power or use a different channel of wireless, which could allow for less interference. Depending on the wireless device you have at home, that actually might require replacing that device in order to take advantage of different frequencies. It also may create a dependence on the devices you have because they might not also work at those frequencies. But if you have relatively new devices over the past 3 or 4 years, you could probably get a new higher powered router or wireless access point to allow you to use those that bigger power. Another option, you could try to build a Faraday cage around the treadmill, which sounds really weird, but basically you want something to absorb all this radiation, this electric radiation that's coming out that is probably interfering with the wireless signal. And chicken wire is pretty inexpensive, and it's an interesting attempt to see what happens. It sounds like a fun science experiment to see how that would work. So you could try to get some kind of wire mesh that you can actually put around the device in which the wireless access point or router is outside of that to see if that helps. It may help, it may not. Generally, for a real Faraday cage, you actually want it completely surrounding the device, so on the bottom, on the sides, and on the top. But at least having a little barrier around it might assist absorb most of that radiation, which would have a lower impact on the wireless quality. But my guess, it's the motor is basically interfering with the wireless. You have to find a way to put a barrier in, or make the wireless higher powered so that it can kind of it doesn't get drowned out by the noise.
That's a sounds like a couple of good options for solutions there. Thanks very much, Janet, for that question. Appreciate your email. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sometimes you see the word refurbished when you're looking at phones or computers for sale. Well, any electronics, really. So basically, what does that mean? And are refurbished things good to buy or okay to buy? Should we be worried about there being something wrong with them?
Normally, refurbished, they might have already been damaged in some way, shape, or form, or there's minor damage that they just wouldn't sell it at full price. Usually, refurbished is somebody returned it, and they're either reselling it after repair, or they're just reselling it. A lot of times, the biggest risk in my mind is usually the limited warranty that comes with a refurbished device. Refurbished device should work just as well as a brand new device. If you have a computer that has a failing part, you replace the part. That new part is hopefully fully functional and you shouldn't have an issue. And most of the time, these refurbished devices are relatively new in it of themselves. So they're not devices that have been used for 2 years, repaired, and then resold. They're usually relatively new. Refurbished devices usually still come with a limited warranty, which is great. They should be fully functional, and they can save you a lot of money. The only challenge comes in if you do have a failure a little bit sooner and that initial warranty has lapsed, you have a potential issue there. But refurbished devices are a nice option because they can save you money. And I'd say most of the time, you're probably going to get a device that will last outside of that warranty period where you don't have to worry about repairing it.
Doug in Mount Horeb, your turn now. Hi, Doug. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I heard the lady who called up with the problem about Wi-Fi being interfered with by a treadmill.
Yeah.
So I had the same problem on our treadmill, and I noticed that when we were walking on the treadmill, I would get static electricity that would cause snapping sounds in a headset that I wore while I was on the treadmill. And coincidentally, when that static from the rubber winding around the belt on the treadmill would make the static in the headset, our Wi-Fi would quit. So I took a sheet metal screw, attached it to the metal on the treadmill, ran a tiny little wire across the floor to the ground screw on the plug in the wall to discharge the static, and that worked.
Oh, good for you, Doug. That's you may have solved a lot of people's problems here today.
Well, I hope it helps.
Thank you very much for calling. Well, that makes total sense, doesn't it?
Yep, and it's actually having a path to ground for anything is always good, especially when you're moving around. I think it's one of the challenges also when it's a little bit colder where we are, where you're moving around and static electricity is out there. You don't want that damaging anything, so actually having an outlet to ground for any of that kind of stuff where you have additional friction is good.
But I
like that idea.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks again, Doug. Jan in Vilas County, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I'm a coordinator for a visually impaired person support group in our area.
Yeah.
We recently had Windows 10 installed in our computers because, Windows 7 is going defunct. Anyway, one of the things we wanted to do was get the voice activated feature that's supposed to be part of Windows 10. And I understand now we need to buy a microphone in order to do that. So my question is, do you have any recommendations? Is there what I should look for in a microphone, or what company might have good microphones and price range?
Sure.
I'd say for, it kind of depends on how you want people to use it. If it's going to be used by multiple people, you can get basic microphones in a pretty inexpensively, and there's a variety of companies out there that'll do it. Ones that you can just have a microphone in front of you that you're utilizing. Something that some people might use if it's more of a one-on-one interaction is actually headphones that do have the sound in addition to the microphone built in. That can be a little bit more usable. It can kind of drown out a little more of the surrounding sound as well. So it always kind of depends on how you'd want that to be used and if it's going to be multiple people. If you have multiple people sharing headphones, it gets a little weird. But if you have a standard microphone that's in front of the computer, it's pretty straightforward, and you can easily clip a lot of those on to a monitor or, you know, a laptop or a different device. Most laptops come with a microphone built in. Most desktops do not. And that's probably where the main challenge is. I think Logitech is a company that I see most of the time with different webcam kits that will have microphones and cameras. They probably have microphones alone as well. But if you look at the webcam area, you're probably actually going to be finding a lot of microphones as well. And I would just take a look at the different devices. I don't think you'd need anything extremely expensive in order to make it function. I think you could spend $10 to $20 on a microphone and it should be okay. If you want to get a high-end headset that has a microphone and kind of some noise canceling on the outside, those might run around, you know, $100 to $200 for a really nice set. But I think if you just want to make sure the voice activation works, I think a $20 microphone hopefully should work fine for day-to-day needs.
And if there is other noise or competing noises around, another thing would be to just look at the microphone and see if, is it a directional microphone? If it's a directional microphone, then you can set it in such a way that it's not going to pick up a lot of the other noises from around the room.
Yeah, that's another good idea.
Does that help, Jan?
Yes, it does. And one of our gentlemen is a writer. Does articles and things, so, but I suppose the same things would apply there, huh?
Yeah, and in that case, I think the usability of using it in a short-term fashion and a long-term fashion are very different. If somebody's using it casually as they're trying to interface, a standalone microphone and a tabletop might work, but if you're using it for hours and hours a day, I'd say a headset is probably going to be better in the long run because it's going to be a little bit more comfortable and it's definitely going to be picking up sound from you very easily. So you don't have to necessarily elevate your voice so that it's listening to you, and it would be a lot easier for multiple hours of use a day.
Yeah, you think you're right about that. So there you go, Jan. Thank you and good luck. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Greg in Pewaukee next. Hi, Greg.
Hi, I have a 20-year-old Gateway desktop computer, which isn't working anymore. The operating system is no longer upgradable. And I want to be able to get all the data off of that hard drive. So do you have a suggestion for how to do that? Should I remove the hard drive and bring it somewhere to get them to transfer? Or what do you suggest? Thank you.
There's actually a couple quick options. One thing I've used many, many times is external hard drive enclosures. You can either get an adapter where you can basically turn your hard drive into an external enclosure. You plug it into a USB port, and if nothing's broken, everything will work and you can pull the data right off of it. So I'd take a look at that option. They're usually pretty inexpensive. You should be able to get one. I'd say for $10 to $20. You can get really high-end enclosures that you probably don't need. But if you just want to be able to pull the data off of it, I think that's a good option. You can take the hard drive out, you plug it in, plug it into a USB port on your computer, pull the data off. If you need to, you can always go to a data recovery company. They might even be able to plug it in just to verify it works. If it does, then you can just go ahead and buy the external adapter, or they might be able to sell you one. The biggest challenge is it broken or not? Because if it's broken, then you're going to need a company to potentially do some additional work on it. If it's not, an external hard drive enclosure might be all you need to pull that data off.
So there you go. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate your call. One of our WPR reporters wrote a story about some city officials in Superior, Wisconsin, considering something called a fiber network. Right now, they're just looking to see what community members think. But well, what's a fiber network like?
Most of the networks that we actually have are usually with a backbone of fiber, which is basically using light to transmit mm-hmm. data. So if you think about a telephone, it actually uses copper wires, even if you don't. Or at least when I think of a traditional phone uses copper wires. We probably don't use those very much anymore. But if they're plugged in, they're using copper. Most of the backbone is using fiber. And a lot of different companies will actually own their own, and they'll resell their internet service over that that backbone, that medium, so you can actually transmit data back and forth. And in this case, you know, a city could put all this fiber in the ground. This is basically one of the main challenges anyone has in more rural areas. I don't have the internet. Well, the reason is they don't have all these wires underneath the ground or on top of the ground to be able to send the internet through. Having fiber available means that hopefully it should be closer so you can tap into that and actually have an internet connection to your house. For different cities, if they had their own network, they can utilize that for other companies to offer their services on the fiber that they own, instead of it being more of a commodity of the individual companies that actually try to sell their services.
And they're trying to do it because they feel like they're paying way too much, and they want to incorporate, I think, competition mm-hmm. into the community, so that you know, if you've got everybody's got to use that same city system, let's say.
Yep, and I think they actually used a comparison between fiber and roads. So in this case, you know, all of the infrastructure that we have for roads, they're, you know, supplied by the city or by the state, depending on where they travel back and forth. But we have a variety of couriers that we either subscribe to or purchase services from for delivering packages, for example. And basically, they want to be able to lay down the road for all these couriers to be able to, you know, sell their business to, and those couriers would have competition. In this case, the couriers are internet providers. Instead of packages, they're moving packets back and forth on the internet so we can view websites and do all the other things we're doing on a day-to-day basis. They just want to make sure the infrastructure is there, and that's usually the hardest part. Once you have the infrastructure in place, you have a lot of options for a variety of services with that being available. But if no one's willing to put it in the ground, nothing happens.
There we go. John in Watertown, your turn. Hi, John.
I have a quick question. I'll try to make it. It's a high-level question. It has to do with motherboards. What conditions would you say would rule out the motherboard as a possible candidate for the symptoms? And I realize it's an unfair question, so I apologize.
One thing, if I were to troubleshoot a motherboard, there are a few things I would do. The first thing I would do is unplug everything from the motherboard, including memory. Then plug in the power to the motherboard, try to turn it on. Normally, without memory installed, you're going to get beeps. If you get no beeps, it probably means an issue with the motherboard. If you get beeps, it's like, okay, it knows there's no memory. Let me put memory in. And I would basically go ahead and start plugging different devices in. usually the motherboards that you, if you are purchasing your own computer, actually come through with these are the beep codes or these are the lights you can see and these are what the errors are. And usually you want to start with nothing else plugged in, then plug in your power and try to turn it on, then plug in memory, try to turn it on, then plug in a different device, which maybe next would be a hard drive and try to plug it on or turn it on, and just see basically where it fails. And usually when you get to a point where there's a failure, it means the device you plugged in is bad or what you plugged it into was bad. So if you have memory and you plug it into a slot and, okay, we have an error, well, if you move it into a different slot and it works, it tells you it's the slot. If it has an error on each slot, you might want to try a different piece of memory. So it's a lot of trial and error, but it all starts with stripping it down to nothing and plug in one thing at a time and note all the failures. It can be tedious, but throughout that process, you should be able to figure out whether it's a motherboard issue or a component issue. The challenge is if you don't have extra components to test that you know are functional, you might have some issues. If you're not sure if it's the memory or the motherboard and don't have extra memory to test, then you're going to kind of run into a challenge there. But strip it down and try one piece at a time.
All right. Makes good sense. Thank you, John. Appreciate your call. Betty in DeForest, have you got a quick question for us?
Yeah. The external hard drive that I had sitting on my desk, and it got knocked off. When I went to plug it back in, it's making a clicking sound, and I can't retrieve anything off of it. Is there a company I could go to repair it?
There are. And what I'd recommend doing is if you even just look for data recovery services, you're probably going to get a list of companies. A lot of the main retailers that do any kind of computer repair either will do some of those services themselves or they will outsource it to other companies. In your case, that sound you're noticing is actually a little arm physically hitting the hard drive. So I would recommend not turning it on again because the more you hear that, the more damage it's creating.
Oh.
And in this case, you really definitely would need a data recovery service that can actually take apart a hard drive usually in order to try and get the data. The downside is it's relatively expensive, but I would recommend going to either a retailer or a data recovery specialist to at least get more information on what it could cost to get the data back.
There you go, Betty. Thank you so much for calling. And Jesse, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by.
Yeah. Thanks for allowing me to be here.
Well, you'll be back in a couple of months or so, and we'll do it all over again.
Sounds great.
Jesse LeGrew is an information security architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. Great to have him with us. And great to have you listening in. Thanks so much for being with us. And tune in tomorrow. We'll talk about some female athletes breaking stereotypes and barriers. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.